Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. It is the news roundup where we discuss stories making regional headlines. And while it is still technically summer, the signs of fall are all around us. Kids are back in school. There's a lot more room on the beaches and road construction projects are in full swing. This week, CAI's Amy Kolb-Noyes reported on a wastewater treatment project in Yarmouth that's picking up after the summer slowdown. Welcome, Amy.
Thanks for having me, Mindy.
So a lot of towns on the Cape are upgrading wastewater systems to address nitrogen pollution in sensitive estuaries. What does this look like in Yarmouth?
Well, it's a huge project. It includes a new sewage treatment plant and a collection system that covers about two-thirds of the town. And it's a pump system, so they're also constructing 5 pump stations.
So it sounds like a long-term project?
You're right. The plan, as it currently stands, calls for 8 phases that will each take about 5 years to complete, so a 40-year project. And right now, the town's about a year and a half into the first phase.
And what does the first phase entail?
A big part of it is building that treatment plant. That's happening at the Water Department property on Buck Island Road. But the most disruptive part is laying collection pipes. For phase one, that's happening along Route 28, Old Main Street, and on South Shore Drive.
So the pretty busy areas in town, right?
That's right. That's why a lot of the work this summer was pretty much confined to just Old Main Street.
Now that that work is picked back up, I suppose drivers should be expecting more detours and delays?
Yes. But the town's doing its best to mitigate that. Weekly traffic advisories are posted on the town website, and the town's encouraging drivers to use the navigation app Waze. They're posting active construction areas on the app daily, and it will guide drivers around the road work.
Clever.
Yes, Public Works Director Jeff Colby gave props to the town of Barnstable for that idea.
So will work be happening in the same areas for the foreseeable future?
Colby says about half of the current work will be wrapping up soon, and new construction contracts will get underway this fall and winter. So that means excavation work from the west of the Parkers River Bridge all the way down to the Barnstable town line.
Yeah. So leave early for work, and because you get behind the school bus, you get the detours. All right. Another story that you were working on is this coordinated effort to clean up ghost gear. So first of all, remind us what ghost gear is.
Ghost gear is lost or abandoned fishing gear, and there's a lot of it in the waters around New England.
And I understand the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown is playing a big part in that effort?
Yeah, that's right. Laura Ludwig, who started CCS's Marine Debris and Plastics Program, has joined forces with 5 other partner organizations to create the New England GEAR team. And GEAR is an acronym. It stands for Gear Extraction and Response. And they're pooling their ocean cleanup data and making it publicly available on a website that just launched this month. And that's at gear-hub.org.
So who are the other partners?
So there's the Blue Ocean Society for Marine Conservation. That's out of Portsmouth, New Hampshire. The Gulf of Maine Lobster Foundation. Net Your Problem, which has a recycling facility in New Bedford. Oceans Wide, which works out of the Gulf of Maine. And the Rosalia Project for a Clean Ocean, which is based in Vermont, but it conducts cleanups from a research vessel in the Gulf of Maine.
What types of data are they collecting?
Well, mostly what debris has been picked up and when and where. There's an interactive map on the new website that shows the total pounds of debris removed, but Ludwig says they keep detailed records about each type of debris recovered, from rope and buoys and lobster pots to water bottles and other just plastic trash.
Great. CAI's Amy Kolb-Noyes, thank you. Registered nurses at Cape Cod Hospital and Falmouth Hospital have reached a 3-year contract with Cape Cod Healthcare. It appears to have been a difficult negotiation. The nurses' union picketed both hospitals in July and voted to authorize a strike if needed. Meanwhile, 2 other labor groups at Cape Cod Healthcare are taking actions of their own. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here to give us the details on that. Hi, Jeanette.
Good to be here, Mindy.
All right, so let's start with the new contract. This is for registered nurses who work at the hospitals. Tell us what the nurses were looking for, and did they get that in the contract?
Yes, well, raises were one of the big things they were looking for, although not the only thing. And on average, the registered nurses will be seeing 19% higher pay over a three-year period. That is according to the union, the Massachusetts Nurses Association. And that number does also include normal step increases, though, but they are getting a raise. The union says there are also raises specifically for nurses who work nights and weekends and for those who will be teaching other nurses while they work. One thing the nurses did not want to happen, though, was they're going to be required to get in order to, sorry, they were required to get their own health care from Cape Cod Health Care in order to avoid higher copays. So they can choose to go somewhere else. They will have to pay higher copays to do that. The union says not only is that about cost, but it's also about the privacy factor, right? Because healthcare is private and they're being asked to get care from their own coworkers, essentially, really, to avoid those extra costs. So they say that's a privacy issue, but they are going to have to do that in the contract that did make it in. I talked to Jennifer Johnson, who is a spokesperson for the Massachusetts Nurses Association, and she said they are still happy with the contract, though.
So what did Cape Cod Healthcare have to say about the contract?
Well, not much, actually. I asked them to confirm some of the particulars of the contract that had been provided by the union. They would not do that, but they did say in an email that the final contract supports both the nurses and their mission to provide the highest quality care.
So that contract is settled, but now another group of employees at Cape Cod Healthcare is also, they've taken a vote on a possible strike, but just like before, this doesn't necessarily mean a strike will happen. So tell us about that.
Yes, so this second group also is registered nurses, but instead of being the hospital-based nurses, they are the visiting nurses. And like with the other vote, a vote to authorize a strike is not a vote to actually go on strike. It says they will authorize a strike in the event that they feel they need it if the negotiations do not reach an agreement. So these visiting nurses work for the Visiting Nurse Association of Cape Cod, which is part of Cape Cod Healthcare. And those nurses announced this month that they have, like the hospital nurses, taken that vote. They do have some negotiations scheduled, which are ongoing right now. And the Mass Nurses Association says they have many of the same issues as the hospital nurses, including, again, things like the pay and the healthcare copays. On this one, Cape Cod Healthcare did have a little bit more to say about it. They said they're committed to bargaining in good faith. They value their nurses. And they say that the proposal they've presented in the negotiations would make the VNA nurses among the highest paid home healthcare professionals in the region.
I want to ask you if there's been any update on the other labor issue at Cape Cod Healthcare. This is about other types of providers, including physician's assistants seeking to unionize.
Yeah, this is interesting because these folks are not unionized at Cape Cod Healthcare now. They are nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and certified nurse midwives. These are collectively known as advanced practice providers. And they did sign union cards this summer asking for a vote on whether or not they would join the same union that represents the registered nurses, which, again, is the Mass Nurses Association. But in order to do that, they have to get a vote scheduled by the National Labor Relations Board. Long story short, no, there is no update because that vote has not been scheduled yet. The Mass Nurses Association says that in the recent past, when Framingham Union Hospital had their RNs unionize, they did experience kind of a delay of a few months in getting the NLRB to set that date. So they're not surprised, but there's no date yet.
All right, more to come. CAA's Jeanette Barnes, thank you.
All right, thanks.
An attempted murder last week in Mashpee has the Mashpee Enterprise looking into the background of the alleged suspect. Callie Ramalot from the Mashpee Enterprise joins us. Bring us back to what happened a week or so ago and then what you found.
Yeah, absolutely. So this incident occurred in the early hours of Monday, September 1st. A woman was in her home and a man allegedly broke in and attacked her with a knife. She was stabbed in both the face and the thigh shortly after midnight. and the man fled the scene once the woman's brother, who lived next door, came over after he heard the commotion. She did survive. I'm not sure what her current condition is, but she is alive. And we did some digging into the background of the alleged suspect. His name is Edward Robinson. And what we found was that he has a pretty extensive, legal track record stretching back, well over a decade. Many of those are violent crimes. He's been charged with over a dozen felonies since 2013. And to give you some more, specific numbers, I found that he was charged with assault and battery 3 times, assault and battery on a family or household member 5 times, and assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, which is a felony, 6 times. And that is just over the since 2013 up until this most recent incident.
Do we know if the suspect knew the woman who was stabbed?
We do believe they knew each other. The nature of their relationship has not been made public or clarified by police, but we do believe that there was a previous relationship there.
Yeah. And then, so he was arraigned this week?
Yes. So he was arrested 2 days after the incident, Wednesday, September 3rd, and arraigned the following day, so Thursday the 4th. And he was charged with attempted murder, assault and battery, threat to commit a crime, home invasion, mayhem, and assault and battery with a dangerous weapon and defacing property. And then that day after his arraignment, he was ordered held without bail. And the following day, Friday, September 5th, he was found to be dangerous. So he's going to be held at Barnstable House of Corrections until his next court appearance or 120 days, whatever comes first.
Troubling story, for sure.
Very, very much, yes.
Another really sad story that you're reporting this week, and that is a dog that died in a dog's care center, a second one in a year?
Yeah, so this is over at Cape Cod Dog Center in Mashpee. It's on Evergreen Circle. And last Labor Day, I'll bring you back first, there was a dog named Mo. He was a 7-year-old Newfoundland, and he died while he was being boarded at the kennel of bloat. And it was a really unfortunate situation. And the dog's owner came forward with the story and went public and wanted to draw attention to what she perceived as a lot of issues at the dog center. Since then, they've implemented a ratio of 1 staff member to 15 dogs. And that was implemented earlier this year. So that is how they run the business now. And on August 27th, there was a second incident. So just about a year after Mo's death, and this incident occurred while the dogs were being moved, like during kennel shifts, and a large dog and a small dog came into contact, which was not supposed to happen. And ultimately, the larger dog ended up killing the smaller dog.
Mm. Do we know, what that, you said they're not supposed to come into contact with each other. So do we know what happened?
We don't know exactly what happened. We do know that the police responded to the dog center at around 6:18 p.m. for a report of an altercation between 2 dogs. We're not sure exactly what went down, but officers were able to confirm that one of the dogs, the smaller one, was deceased. And the owner of Cape Cod Dog Center has said that this was not a fight, but it is unclear what the nature of the actual interaction was.
So not a fight. Altercation. Mm-hmm. So I guess maybe a reactive dog. We don't know.
Yeah, the exact wording that was used was the reaction of one dog led to the tragic and sudden loss of the other's life.
Yeah, so, that was so terribly sad for everybody.
Very, very sad.
Kelly Romelot with the Mashpee Enterprise. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
Coming up after break, fear in immigrant communities on the rise after ICE announces Massachusetts raids. You're listening to The Point. It is the News Roundup. This week, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement launched Operation Patriot 2.0, a surge of immigration-related arrests in Massachusetts, and that has prompted fear in immigrant communities. Sam Houghton from the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Mindy.
So what are you seeing on the vineyard?
Yeah, well, right, a lot of fear and panic, I think. But as listeners probably remember, there was this large ICE raid. They hit the island in May, something like 40 people detained on the vineyard in Nantucket. And that was part of that much wider sweep across Massachusetts where ICE reported something like 1,500 people were taken. A really intense time on the island caused a lot of panic. People were calling out of work, not sending kids to school. And that kind of simmered down a little over the summer But as we're reporting this past weekend, ICE made that statement about Patriot 2.0, something like that. And it really caused this kind of resurgence of fear. You know, we should say we have no indication the island will be targeted. There have been no confirmed reports that ICE has been here since then. But the speculation that they could be back is really scaring folks. You know, we spoke with a pastor at a local church who's saying it's hard to tell, you know, what to tell your congregants. And, you know, I think his main point is, you know, the last time they did this, they said it would be for criminals. But really, from our reporting and from folks he talked to, there is indication that some of the people detained had no criminal history, maybe a lot of them. And that some that we interviewed did have documentation to be working here. So it just causes that fear. Even if you are, you have everything in order, there is worry that you could be swept up in it.
Yeah. And no hard numbers, but anecdotally, you're hearing from some teachers, especially the English language teachers, that immigrant student numbers are down.
Yeah, this is for new immigrant students coming into the country. And I think the numbers, right, are still outstanding. But we've heard that students are kind of starting to come back, maybe. But from the superintendent and individual teachers we spoke to, the island generally has a lot of new immigrant families enrolling their kids for the first time in school. But from what we heard, that hasn't been the case, at least in the first days of school. The administration is actually kind of compiling a report to get a real sense of, you know, what the numbers are, which we haven't seen yet. But, you know, there's some logic there with the administration, federal administration is really creating this fear and, you know, making it more difficult to get in the country. You might not have the same amount of newer students.
Yeah. Lots of uncertainty, as you're saying, if ICE agents will show up, where, when, we just don't know.
Right.
Yeah. All right. This week, Cape and Islands legislators sent a letter to cell phone carriers asking for upgrades in service.
Yeah. So we've been looking at this story for a while, but we kind of had this bigger story in midsummer that we did some investigating and, you know, after actually, frankly, our newsroom was having real problems with our cell phone reception. But, you know, if you just walk around town, you see people drop calls and it gets really worse in the summer when so many people are here. But cell service, particularly bad in towns like Aquinnah and Chilmark, more remote areas. And for emergency responders is a real concern there. There was one instance when there was a near drowning, but I guess first responders are having a hard time locating the individual because of bad cell service. But kind of the rub of this story is Chilmark banned cell towers several years ago. So these wireless providers came in and built these nodes around town. They're little transmitters that provide provide reception. And what we're finding is there are about 30 of these around town, but they're harder to fix when they break. It's not like you can respond to one tower. So the service has gotten worse and people are complaining more and more. And the select board actually took it up this week, saying they want to bring in providers to a meeting to see if they can do something. And then we got this letter from the state delegation this week that they're upset and they're really calling for providers to do more.
Yeah. Any response yet from those that were sent the letter?
We have not. We are still working with providers. You know, these are big national corporations that it's hard to get a spokesperson for. But, you know, Verizon has said that they want to come to the island and make some changes. I think really interesting is they want to do their own kind of transmitter service up in Aquinnah and Chilmark. And we are being told that if they do go forward with that, it could be actually a problem for the other provider.
Oh, boy.
So I think it's a complicated situation. But people are, you know, I think we're more and more reliant on cell phones nowadays rather than home phones.
Yeah, right. So definitely more to come on this story. All right. Big Fish in Derby coming up on Sunday.
Yeah, right. Always a good time. Right, the Derby, the big news here, it's turning 80, and they're kind of giving a special shout out to the fishermen who have been fishing into their 80s, who will be fishing this year. And we actually caught up with two brothers, I believe in their 90s, who are still fishing the Derby. One of them, this will be his 79th Derby, which is
wow.
Pretty cool. I know. And it was great. One of the brothers we quoted was, you know, we were kind of asking, you know, why are you still doing this? And he's like, well, I'm trying to win.
So funny.
And it is, you know, it's a huge event on the island. The winner gets a boat. So there's, you know, there's a lot to it.
Yeah. All right. Sam Houghton from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you, Mindy.
All right. Several Nantucket leaders were up on Beacon Hill this week to advocate for a real estate transfer fee. Josh Bolling from the Inquirer Mirror joins us with more on that story. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
All right. This isn't the first time we've been asking the legislature for a transfer fee, right? So tell us what's happening this time.
Not even close to the first time. Yeah. It's probably been, it's been at least 10 years, at least a decade. So I'd say that Nantucketers have probably been up on Beacon Hill asking for, begging for, pleading for a transfer fee for probably 20 or 30 times already. But once again, they were back up there on Tuesday urging state legislators to support a real estate transfer fee that would fund affordable housing initiatives on the island. They were up there particularly to support a bill that is specific to Nantucket. It's a home rule petition that would allow the island to impose a 0.5% real estate transfer fee on homes that are sold for over $2 million or more, which is the bulk of the homes on Nantucket these days, paid for by the seller. The current land bank fee, which goes for to pay for the purchase of recreational open space and conservation land by the land bank, and that's been around for 30 or so years, is a 2% fee on almost all transactions, and that's paid for by the buyer. This bill resembles and is a precursor to actually the statewide opt-in proposal that made it to Governor Maura Healey's into her bond bill last year, but was stripped out at the 11th hour before its passage.
And the police chief also testified, and I thought this was interesting. 67 full-time employees in her department, only 12 own homes, and those are almost all the senior staff members.
I would say they're probably exclusively the senior staff members. Yeah. It is nearly impossible for even a two-income family on the island, two very good incomes, to afford a home on the island. The average home price, the average sales price on the island last year and into this year is $4 million. The median home price, the middle of the market, is $3.7 million. It's nearly impossible on the open market for year-round working people, regardless of what kind of jobs they have, to afford homes on Nantucket, which is why the transfer fee is being advocated for so much. The islands have basically said, we need to create a secondary real estate market for year-round residents and the workforce on the island, which involves subsidies and, you know, all kinds of different programs that, you know, create a different housing market that's outside of the regular market that our seasonal residents, visitors can afford.
Yeah, and we mentioned this has been going on for quite a while, a decade anyway, but are folks feeling confident that this time it might actually pass? I know being designated a seasonal community is helping, right? So how are people feeling about this?
I think that's sort of a two-part question. Being designated a seasonal community is a wonderful thing. We actually had a conversation in the office yesterday with State Senator Julian Sear, and the point he made and the point we've sort of been writing about and talking about as well is that the seasonal community designation creates a wonderful toolbox of tools to address affordable housing concerns, but you still need the money to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And that's where the transfer fee comes from, potentially instead of a statewide tax that might might be distributed for affordable housing programs statewide. But the second part of that question, you know, I don't know if our leaders and our residents are any more confident this time. You know, like I said, you know, is the 11th time the charm? Is the 12th time the charm? It's a tough row to hoe, and you know, there's been a number of different modifications and changes to the proposals over the years, and there's still a very strong lobby on Beacon Hill that does not want to see any additional fees, taxes, whatever you want to call them, on real estate, and it's a tough hurdle to get over. But I think there's hope, but I don't know if there's confidence.
All right, we'll see. We have talked many times about how large the deer population is on the island, and now we have a new tool being announced.
We do. Mass Wildlife, the state wildlife agency, does have a new tool that really intended to help thin troublesome deer herds across the state, and it just might help some of Nantucket's largest homeowners, landowners, including the land bank, to get rid of some of the deer that are really kind of taking over the open spaces and even not so open spaces on the island. I got to work this morning, and trotting down the center of the street that goes behind the office were two fawns just merrily making their way down the street. So they're everywhere, right in the middle of the island. And this is called a deer damage permit. And what it does, it offers some options outside the regular hunting seasons that occur sort of in late fall, early winter across the state and on the islands in particular. It's a little bit more flexible than even the older laws that allowed for the removal of deer outside of the hunting season. It's not considered hunting, and it can occur, you know, year-round with some pretty significant restrictions. It's limited to large tracts of land, property owners who own about 300 acres or more, and those who can prove that at least 50% of their income comes from agriculture. Then there are permits issued to take deer on those properties at any time of the year. There's also some other issues. They can use rifles instead of just shotguns. They can bait for the deer. It's really an effort to eliminate, not so much eliminate, but to curb the deer populations. Mass Wildlife says that the optimum deer population for most communities is about 14 or 15 per square mile. Nantucket has 85 deer per square mile.
Wow.
It's among the largest, if not the largest, highest density deer population in the state. And it's not just sort of for aesthetic reasons. They do a lot of damage to flower gardens and vegetable mm-hmm. gardens, but they also are the primary carrier of and transfer of the deer tick that causes Lyme and other tick-borne diseases. They are also causing, contributing to coastal erosion. They are trampling on coastal banks and causing coastal erosion. Not to mention, they are in the streets, and there have been a few very close near misses between cars and deer, and some vehicles have struck deer as well, and that's never a good thing.
Yeah, and the poor deer, they're starving to death. I mean, they'll eat anything, even the things that people say deer won't eat. They will on Nantucket.
They've gotten to that point, and there are, the deer on Nantucket, I wouldn't quite say they're emaciated yet, because they're, again, given the fact that more than 50% of the island is open space, mm-hmm. there's a lot for them to eat. But the fact that they are, coming into densely populated residential neighborhoods, we've seen them on Main Street before, does show that they're definitely in search of food.
Yeah. Josh Bolling, Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
Food insecurity, huge problem across our region, and the Food for Kids Summer Program saw a big increase in demand. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle has more on that story. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mindy.
So this is a program that's been around for a little bit, and need just keeps increasing every summer, right?
Yeah, it's been around for about 13 years. It's based out of a church in Orleans, and this year they actually had added 6 new locations because of demand. And, the folks behind the program told us that they thought they'd be doing about 80 more lunches or so based on that. They ended up with doing at least 200 more lunches per day.
Wow.
In the program. And an additional over the summer, they estimate that they served approximately 10,000 more meals than they did last year. So that's a lot of kids who are not getting the food that they need, through their usual sources.
Yeah. And so one of the things that they're doing is looking for more community partners, right, to keep up with this demand?
Exactly. In their current location at the Church of the Holy Spirit in Orleans, they really are up against space limitations. They can't really accommodate any additional folks helping out there. And so what they did this year to accommodate the bigger demand was that they just worked longer hours, the volunteers. But right now they're looking for sort of a satellite location to set up an additional kitchen where food can be cooked and prepared. They don't know if they'll be able to get that up and running for next summer, but they're hoping that they can get some kind of relief.
Yeah.
Because, this is probably going to continue,
right,
the way things are, right?
And in the summers, it's an important time because the kids are out of school, and some of the kids actually, get some food at school. But once they're out of school, there really aren't a lot of options, right?
Exactly. And the Food for Kids program goes really where the kids are in the summer, to rec programs and community centers, locations like that, to try to get those kids who would have gotten their lunch meals,
yeah,
through school, but you know they're not there obviously during the summer, and a lot of them go to these town programs, and that's where they're able to find them and make sure they have at least one good meal a day.
Yeah. In a related story, the Harwich in Harwich, the People's Fridge and People's Garden getting some needed help.
Sure. The People's Garden and People's Fridge were started by the town to, again, supplement folks in town who may need additional food to sort of stretch their budgets. The People's Garden, which is located at the town's cultural center, they received a donation of a greenhouse from the Harwich Conservation Trust. It's one that was going to be taken off property that they just acquired, so they donated it to them. And the program also received the People's Fridge Program, which is located at the community center, received a $2,500 pledge of food from Star and Shaw's Market, which will help provide additional resources for those folks. And also Whole Foods in Hyannis are providing some seed starter and potting mix to the garden so that that can give them a jump start next year on their growing of fresh vegetables for local folks.
And some may recall it's been almost a year since a car drove through the front entrance of Larry's PX. It's taken a while, but they're scheduled to reopen next week.
Indeed, it has taken quite a while. It's been 9 months since that happened, right around Thanksgiving Day last year. But they've persevered through insurance claims and lawsuits and all sorts of different things. And finally, expect to open the doors next Wednesday in their location at the Shopaway Plaza in West Chatham. Jay Case, who's the owner, co-owner with his wife, took us through a little tour of the renovated restaurant, and it looks good. It looks like it pretty much did originally, but a little cleaner, a little more upgraded. And he's been able to get back most of his employees, and a lot of folks in town, I can tell you, are looking forward to next Wednesday.
Yeah, a little facelift and some familiar faces, right?
Exactly.
All right, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Mindy.
Coming up after a break, the latest from the State House and more access to mental health services on the Outer Cape. Stay with us. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. Access to mental health care is a huge issue, particularly on the Outer Cape. This week, a new online mental health program was announced, and Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent is here to tell us more. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Mindy.
We've talked about this a lot. You know, so many folks who would like to get some mental health services are having a tough time, and especially when you're in a crisis situation, weeding through kind of what resources are where can be so difficult. Tell us about this new initiative.
Yes, well, it's actually called Credible Mind, and it's a collaboration between the eight towns of the Outer and Lower Cape. So that's Provincetown, Truro, Wellfleet, Eastham, Brewster, Harwich, Chatham, and Orleans. And it's an online platform that has some self-assessment tools and a list of resources that are available for people who might be struggling or in a crisis. Coincidentally, this was announced on September 2nd, which was the day that a very beloved person in the Provincetown community, Chuck Jacinta, took his own life. And it was a shocking event. He's very well known in town as a server, bartender, and restaurant manager. And the select board talked about it on September 8th at their meeting. Eric Borg, one of the members, said he was an incredibly kind and hardworking person and not someone you would expect to be struggling. It's really shocking, said Borg. And Dave Abramson, the chair of the board, said, there is help in this town. The more we talk about it, the less stigma there is, and more people will be willing to talk about what's going on and seek help. So this new platform is just one of the things that are available, the four Outer Cape towns actually employ jointly a public health nurse and a therapist whose services are free with no insurance required. The assistant town manager in Provincetown, Dan Riviello, pointed out that those resources haven't really been very well publicized. For example, the town websites for Truro, Wellfleet, and Eastham, which help pay for these resources, their health department pages don't even mention them. Mm. So Riviello is trying to change that and do something about it. In Provincetown, there is a navigator, a community resource navigator, who helps refer people to resources. And that navigator can be reached by calling 774-209-3222 or emailing crnavigator@outercape.org. The navigator works through Outer Cape Health Services. Paul Benson wrote a really important article about all of this in this week's Provincetown Independent. All of this information can be found in his article online.
Right. Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent. Thanks, Ed. Now we head to the news from Beacon Hill as CAI's Gilda Geist checks in with our Statehouse reporter, Katie Lannon.
Governor Mara Healey recently announced plans to change the state's environmental review process for some new housing. What is she trying to achieve with these plans?
The idea is that it'll make it ultimately faster to build certain housing types and new housing developments here in Massachusetts, where there's obviously a housing shortage. The state pegs the need at almost 250,000 new homes in the next decade. So the governor is trying to make it so that certain types of housing, when they're being built, can get a streamlined environmental review, moving a process that can take some projects more than a year down to 30 days with the goal of avoiding added costs, uncertainty, and delays along the way.
What did Healey have to say about the potential environmental impact of these changes to the review process?
So Healey and her team are basically saying that they'll be making sure they're upholding the state's high environmental standards with this more streamlined option. And they say they want to use it to encourage housing that's denser, energy efficient, and climate resilient. And the idea behind what they're doing here is it would focus on specific types of housing development that meet particular criteria to kind of minimize what the environmental impact could be. For example, it couldn't be built in a floodplain or another high-risk area. It would need to comply with energy efficiency standards. There has to be transit access or other ways to limit the extent of new traffic. So they're looking at a specific bucket of new housing, not all housing, that could have huge environmental impacts.
All right, and moving on to another housing-related story. Beacon Hill lawmakers held a hearing recently about real estate transfer fees. So before we get into what happened at the hearing, can you remind us what exactly is on the table here?
Yeah, to cut through the jargon a little bit, this is the idea that's been kicking around for many years now, where there's plenty of communities, including in the Cape and Islands, that want the option to charge a new fee or tax on the sale of certain usually luxury homes and take that money and put it towards affordable housing. This is something that Governor Healey tried to get through the legislature last session, but couldn't. And many communities are back at it once again, asking for Beacon Hill's permission to let them do this at the local level.
And what did people who attended the hearing have to say about this policy proposal?
This has been something that's really opposed by the real estate industry writ large, particularly Boston-based groups. But lawmakers heard from people who work in that field, in Martha's Vineyard, for instance, who said that they like the idea of a transfer fee because the need for housing and affordable housing is so great. The idea that in the seasonal communities, they really need another tool to keep bringing on new year-round homes, prevent the existing ones from being turned into luxury rentals. These are the arguments that people have been making this week. before the legislature, and we'll have to see if ultimately this is the year that they are able to convince lawmakers to go along with it. They're pointing to the idea that Massachusetts is losing federal revenue and making the case that, well, maybe cities and towns should be given this option to generate more of their own revenue for housing.
That's Gilda Geisen, our State House reporter, Katie Lannon. The State Division of Marine Fisheries issued an advisory this week warning lobster fishers of low oxygen conditions in parts of Cape Cod Bay. CAI's Gilda Geisen caught up with Malcolm Scully, a senior scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, to learn more about what low oxygen zones are and why they happen.
What is a low oxygen zone?
So a low oxygen zone is something that forms in waters around the world, really. In a lot of places, it's a seasonal phenomenon. So what happens is, as we move from the winter spring months into summer, the surface waters begin to get very, very warm and the bottom waters remain cool. And that is because the surface and the bottom waters are not mixing. And so typically organic material sinks to the bottom where bacteria use it, and that process uses up oxygen. And so as we move into the summer months, when there's very little vertical mixing between the surface and the bottom, the oxygen levels will slowly go down. And by this time of year, we often see some of the lowest oxygen values of the season. And it'll stick around until we get a really strong, like, wind mixing event as the storms from the fall and the winter begin to roll through. And that will mix the oxygen from the surface down into those bottom waters and relieve this low oxygen condition. We don't need to be worried about it in Cape Cod Bay at this point. The Division of Marine Fisheries put out an advisory, and their advisory is really just indicating that oxygen has reached a value of about 4 milligrams per liter. And so we really start to worry about it when it gets to be 2 milligrams per liter or lower. So it's really just letting people know that things are getting low, but it's not anything that we need to necessarily worry about at this point, because it hasn't gotten to the point where it's causing any significant negative influences on the organisms that live in those bottom waters.
Can you speak to, like, the history of this issue? Is this becoming more of an issue in Cape Cod Bay? Is this something we've been observing for a long time?
The sort of seasonal cycle is pretty normal. It's been getting warm in the summers and cooling off in the winters for as long as we can remember. And so this process where the water column becomes stratified is very normal. And that means that anything that's using up oxygen is going to drive the oxygen to lower levels during this period of time. What is sort of unusual is in 2019, we saw the oxygen get so low that it started to kill benthic organisms, and lobster fishers in the region started pulling up dead lobsters in their pots. And that's really when we became aware of this being sort of an unusual event. And so we went out in 2020 and we saw similarly low values. And so ever since those two summers, we've been sort of keeping a closer eye on this, and we haven't seen oxygen levels get that low since.
Scientists, they don't know the cause of these low oxygen levels. Any theories, any ideas?
We don't know exactly, but we have a pretty good idea that the lack of vertical mixing that supplies oxygen combined with the decomposition of organic matter is really what drives the oxygen down. In 2019 and 2020, we had very anomalous algae blooms. It was a new species of algae. These blooms were found pretty deep in the water column, but it was levels that were 5 times anything we'd ever seen. And so we really think those really high levels of algae biomass, when they died and sank to the bottom, are what depleted the oxygen in 2019 and 2020. That was a new species, and we hypothesized that perhaps that new species was here to stay, but we really haven't seen blooms of this species since. And so that's the part we really don't understand. We know that the climate is changing. We know that when the climate changes, new organisms can become established, but we really aren't at the point where we can predict when these blooms are going to occur. And we didn't see a bloom any of the consecutive summers since 2020. And so we think the low oxygen is really directly related to these unusual algae blooms.
Is there any, like, sort of common misconception about low oxygen zones that you would like to debunk?
In Cape Cod Bay, the seasonal cycle, that's a pretty natural cycle. The unusual part is when we get these species that haven't bloomed before. And so we don't really understand what's causing that, but we think that's directly related to the unusual low oxygen we've seen in Cape Cod Bay. I don't believe what's going on in Cape Cod Bay is due to human-introduced nutrients. The bottom waters of Cape Cod Bay is a giant reservoir of nutrients. It's really the result of a new species more than it is something that humans have done, I think, to change the system.
That's Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution senior scientist Malcolm Scully. Malcolm, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And finally this morning, CAI's Tom Maroney on September's slow roll on the Cape Cod Rail Trail.
The going is easy as I slip under a canopy of shade trees. Push hard on the bike pedals, grunt and groan if I must admit. And once again, I'm off on the 5.9-mile stretch of rail trail that starts at Route 134 in Dennis, over to the Pleasant Lake General Store in Harwich. I've made the journey for years, and this the Cape's best month, September. The crowd's thin and the sun cools, and there are curiosities at every turn for those who decide the going there is better than the getting there. A small bridge carries my bike over a brook that widens out, and I wonder for the moment if any of this ever gets itself to the sea. Now I'm passing behind backyards and feeling like an intruder, peeking in on what most people would never put in the front yard, a garden that didn't take, boxes and buckets of projects, long unfinished, piled against lumber, unused. And that skiff, still in dry dock, still tucked away in a forgotten corner, its bow like a chin pointed straight at me, daring me to criticize. I take pity on these minor delinquencies, remembering what I myself have left undone, and grateful that my backyard can keep its secrets. The woods recede and the scene in front of me opens wide to the first of the cranberry bogs. My route to the general store is defined in large measure by these scrubby rolling carpets, cut by the narrow canals of generations of farmers, and marked by a lonely pump house, a faded red, faded but not forgotten. The sprinklers are going like mad in a frenzied snap too. I pull off onto the sandy shoulder to count the weeks until harvest, when suddenly a hawk rises, dips and soars again in its quest for the next meal. I look toward the trail ahead, where a family of six seems to be coming right at me, each on their own e-bike. One of the youngest is busy talking to the others when he veers close enough that I have to jerk my own bike out of the way to avoid a big crash. Besides giving me a scare, I think they must have missed seeing the hawk. Yeah, well, you go too fast, you miss too much. I pass an abandoned bog being converted to wetlands. The cranberry plants have been scooped out, clearing the way for fresh habitat for birds and other creatures that will call it home. I hear the skittering away in the woods of a small creature I must have startled, too clever to ever make itself visible to me. A few hundred yards later, a fox darts down a small embankment and disappears. We are indeed intruders here, but hopefully the denizens sense that most of us simply want a closer look for a better understanding of their world. I get off my bike and walk down to the edge of Hinckley's Pond. Along the shoreline, I spot the corners of houses coming out from the lush cover of trees. And then I see the tail end of all things, a small aircraft. Maybe a seaplane that lands and takes off from here? Now the general store is in sight. I'll sit on the bench with a cup of ice cream and think about the ride back. Much to see on September's slow roll. And about that seaplane, I made a few calls that led me to Tim Howard, manager of the Chatham Airport. He knew all about it. He said the old Cessna is no longer airworthy, so for now it's simply one of the rail trail's more interesting pieces of landscape art.
And you can see photos on our website, capeandislands.org. That wraps up this week's News Roundup. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.